This is the fourth session, I guess, in the series on Jesus and power. My name is Larry Rasmussen. We've talked about power as coercion. We've talked about power as ideology. And we're working on formulae up here for competing with the scientists in the village. So P equals C to the power of I. And tonight we're going to talk about power as nurture. The series as a whole works between our experience and observations of power and what we see as power in the materials in the Gospels, in particular what the power that we see in Jesus and the movement around Jesus. You have to have, I think, an impressive sense of humor and be slightly deranged to think that much can be said about Jesus and about power, much less about Jesus and power together, in five short sessions. But we have some humor and we are deranged. So on we go, undaunted by reality. The hymn that we're going to sing is number 474. The topic is Power as Nurture. This hymn was written by a Swedish woman, Carolyn van Sandelberg, from in the last century. It won't take you long to recognize the power of God here as God, as nurturer. God is nurturer in this very familiar hymn. Although the question, I guess, is for some people whether nurture is experienced as a power, and I want us to explore that tonight. Okay. You can sit for singing this. You don't have to stand. When we sang stand up for Jesus, we have to stand. But on this one, you can sit. It's a somewhat different mood from that other one, too, I might add.
Yes.
What kind of power do you associate with it? Or if you don't associate nurturing, or pick some images from this hymn, tending. God is known to tend and nourish. In his holy courts they flourish. Ne'er forsaketh. refuge. Preserving. Tell me what associations nurture has with power. Or if it fails to have it, why? It must mean that there's some other notion of power there. Yeah,
I think I see nurture as more feminine, and that said something I related to. The power of nurturing seems to come more from females, that, for me, sometimes. That's often associated with feminine. So this him, for me, seems, I don't know, I'm struggling with it. I did change the words as I was saying. Because I think the power of nurture is also a very feminine quality, but it's also something males are capable of, but it seems in our society less capable of.
Do you think if Carolyn Van Sendel Berg were writing it today, she might have written Children of the Heavenly Mother?
I don't know.
Yeah.
She might have written Children of Her Heavenly Mother, and they wouldn't publish it then.
So
I sent it back to the publishers and said his. It reads more authentic if you substitute mother.
Does it?
And her instead of his. Mm. That's the way I sang it, and it sang just fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's also some men, I think.
No, I'm not trying to say that men are capable of nurturing. It's just that's something that we're not brought up in our male societies.
To think
that's
of it
not
as power.
Something that's really given to us. That it's not, it's something we're separated from.
I think many men nurture. I don't think many men think of it as a power.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. I don't think women do.
Oh.
What it does, I feel it. Oops.
Go ahead.
Let's. Did you want to say more about that?
Well, I'm not sure if it's because of the associations I have with which people nurture, or why. But I don't. I haven't seen it as a power.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose it could be interpreted that way. If you have power over someone, when you nurture them, you're somehow in control. I'm not sure.
Well, maybe it's a matter of empowering as you nurture.
Mm. Oh, yeah, let's talk about this. Is nurturing an empowering kind of power? I mean, that's a funny way to put it. But there's a direction there. That seems consistent with nurturing. That it intends to enhance the power of the person being nurtured, whether it's in an unequal relationship as parents to children, where you don't have equal strength or something. You're enhancing the personhood and the power of that child, or whether it's in an equal relationship between friends.
I think it works both ways, though. You can nurture someone and keep them in that role, so you can continue to be the nurturer and in control somehow.
Yeah.
I think parents do that to their children, and not meaning to empower them.
Mm.
And the other way to use nurture, though, is nurturing someone's creativity or something else, which doesn't, you know, hold you to them.
Yes.
But to me, nurturing is a powerful way to show your love. Mm.
How so? I mean, why is that a powerful way? We say that easily and we all shake our heads yes, but what we're trying to do here is describe some of those dynamics. How does it work? Why is that powerful?
Because isn't it?
It shows that someone else really cares about you.
Isn't it powerful because you're enabling that person to become who they are, to maximize their potential?
It's an increase of their own power, in a sense. Yeah.
One of the larger powers, it would seem to me, would be the power of influence in a situation like that when you're talking about nurture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is a power of influence. To sort of name this kind of power, it is a power of influence. That's one way to name it. Imitation.
You know, if you model that, then someone else can model that and keep going.
Yeah. One of the things I remember from the very first parent-teacher association meeting that we had at the grade school where our son was the opening introduction to the school by the principal. And he was telling the parents gathered the criteria for hiring teachers. And he said, particularly in the lower grades, we look for a person worthy of invitation. I thought it was a wonderful way to say something very important about what the school wanted to see happen. But that was a nurturing kind of power, that the children then would look upon that person as someone they would like to be like and things they would like to imitate about them, and that would be a part of their, a very important part of their nurture. Didn't ask, were they really good at math and social studies? Were they persons worthy of imitation?
It seems like part of the reason that nurturing is very powerful is because of the impact it has on the other person. I think it has, can have, especially in the parent-child situation or teacher-small-child situation, a great, great impact on the one being nurtured.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's powerful. It's, there is a lot of power there for that reason.
I'm sometimes asked, since I teach social ethics, you know, when is an opportune time to be teaching social ethics, and the references to age groups. I mean, you shouldn't be junior high or high school, or do you wait till business school or med school or what?
Yeah.
No. And I often say 2 and 3.
Yeah.
That's the time. No, you don't have. You have to find the right way to teach it. But so many things which are so basic happen so early on, and it just makes your point that those are situations of nurture, really focused nurture, deliberate oftentimes, or at least it comes with the territory,
right.
And it is powerful. It is forming of human character, the kinds of person that we will be. If you shape the kinds of persons that people will be, you have an awesome power in your hands. Yeah.
In our parish, we have a mentor program as part of our confirmation program.
What kind of program?
A mentor program.
Mentor program, yeah.
Where the confirmant chooses an adult to be the confirmant's mentor.
Yeah.
And we also, in the same process, have them interview a senior citizen and then write a report and apply church history.
So good.
And not only do the young people feel special because they are nurtured by the adults, but to see the glow on the adults at having been given the time and the interest of these young people.
The nurturing is reciprocal there.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And everybody just kind of marches around glowing that they are in these special relationships, and it's very empowering.
That's lovely. I've heard several names now for this kind of power. I've heard influence, I've heard imitation, I've heard mentoring. Both the hymn and our comments refer to kind of parental and power of friendship.
I've been wondering whether it's really, if it's nurturing in God's presence, whether it's really any power that we have at all, whether it's power that's really God's power, and if it's not, then are we trying to control the person, trying to manipulate the person? And is what really is nurturing? Is it allowing God to work through us with the child? Or is it something that we're trying to do with the child?
Mm-hmm. Probably needs to be made at each session, talking about each kind of power in here, is that that kind of power can go very wrong. And that's true for nurturing as well, or what is intended to be nurturing as well. And it may well be an attempt to control, to channel, to restrict, to form in a way that doesn't take care of the others' needs or own partnership in the relationship. Yeah.
You haven't mentioned marriage as another place of nurturing.
I haven't, no. Sure, I mean,
partners, I was thinking partners, marriage yeah. is that being that same yeah. thing.
Yeah. Yes, please.
One of the most powerful nurturing things in my life was as a kid growing up and going to a little country school in Montana. The teacher would usually be the only person who was new to the community. And I practically worshiped that teacher. But the nurture, the love, the learning, the personalities that they made me respond to has been one of the most important influences in my life.
Mm-hmm. Growing up. Mm-hmm. How old were you?
Yes. Well, I suppose I was from 6 to 13. Mm-hmm. In that period of time.
Mm-hmm. Most of us can point to people who stand out at some point or another and are important to us. And most of the associations are some kind of nurturing associations.
But this goes back 70 years ago.
So that's significant.
Yeah,
that's
a
significant memory.
I still remember the names of those people from the book.
Yeah. I could tell you about Miss Quested, and I probably can when I'm 72.
A humbling experience led by Martin Marty a few years ago at the Northwestern Seminary was when he said, a bunch of pastors, okay, write down the titles of the five most meaningful sermons you've ever heard.
Yeah.
And all these clergy just kind of stared at each other. You couldn't think of any. And then he said, okay, name five of the most important people in your life.
Yeah.
And they were all busy writing immediately.
Yeah. Be thinking now. I'm going to go on to some materials that I want to share with you from some of the literature, but I want this to be a part of coming back to the conversation about what kind of power the power of nurture is. Try to be descriptive of it. We recognize it, I think, have named it a power. Can we say more about it? And then, at the end of the hour, then I want to focus especially on the question of, do you see that kind of power in Jesus and in the movement around Jesus? And how would you describe it if you do see it there? Let me, in getting to that point, share with you some materials. I have found for myself that the writings of Christian feminists these days are extremely instructive about power, not only nurturing power, but the other kinds of power that we had talked about, coercion and ideology, and tomorrow about energy. But I've picked this evening to share some of the consensus, I think, that's found in the writings of a number of Christian feminists, because they do give particular attention to the power of reciprocal and mutual relationships, the power of giving and receiving care. And thus I interject that here. I don't want to homogenize what in fact is a very diverse group of people. And I have made a couple of the distinctions that are noteworthy on the board in the recommended books. One of the books that we do have in the bookstore, and which I asked the bookstore to carry for us, is The Chalice and the Blade, by Ryan Eisler. And it is about as good a piece of, as I have seen. I can't claim to have read a lot of what is in fact an explosion of literature. But from what I have read, it's a fine explication of a lot of, especially white feminist, not in this case Christian feminist, but white feminist writings on models of power and community. And she distinguishes between what she calls dominator model and partnership model. Dominator model of community ranks people in relation to one another. A partnership model of community, instead of ranking, links. A dominator model of community values conformity and power as keeping, tending the boundaries and keeping things orderly and in control. A partnership model of community sees power as affiliation and values diversity and works from differences, often toward a common good, but from differences. And then she uses the chalice as her symbol of the partnership community, the kind of thing that we've done in chapel where the circle, everyone in the circle is at the same distance from one another, and in that sense represents a kind of equality. The cup of salvation is a cup offered to all equally. It's a chalice. The baptismal font is also round and is in all our baptized, making the commitment so, but it's a gift, it's an invitation to all, which does not make distinction, which does not rank. And then the blade is her symbol for really weapon and violence and power as brute coercion. Now, she's an anthropologist. She knows full well that there is no single type of society. So this is a typology. And she says every society is some combination of dominator and partnership. But the proportion matters immensely. And one or the other will be more basic, and then the other will be secondary. The thing that fascinated me about this book is that she, as an anthropologist and a historian, finds her partnership model reflected in Jesus. And she's not a Christian and she's not a believer. But the kind of thing that she has seen in some other places, she also sees in the Jesus community, the characteristics of her partnership model, and in conflict with a dominator model. So she has a chapter in there on Jesus, and I thought that was really quite intriguing. Now, while I'm talking about books, let me also say that there's a significant difference in the writings of feminists between white Christian feminists and African American feminists. And so I have also put up on the board a helpful book by Jacqueline Grant, White Women's Christ and Black Women's Jesus, and where Jackie Grant talks about the women's movement in terms of whether one is white and whether one is black and what difference it makes and how one relates then in one religious faith. And in the African American community, the strong name of Jesus continues. A lot of white feminists have trouble with Jesus but have some notion of a Christ figure. So that's a helpful discussion. They share a lot in common, and I'm going to talk about what they share in common, but I wanted to point to some of the differences as well. Then, feminists write not only about power as caring and power as nurture, but a great deal about power as coercion, and invariably favor nonviolent shared power, power on a partnership model. That raises the question as to what degree and kind of coercion may be necessary in a society. We talked earlier in the week about how no society exists apart from some degree of the exercise of power as coercion. There simply isn't a society that has or does exist on those terms. So, feminists also address the question, what kind and degree of coercion is necessary? And at that point, there's disagreement. And if you want to track some of the disagreement and some of the discussion over various kinds of power within feminist literature, the article by Lynn Singer, Value, Power, and Gender, Do We Need a Different Voice, is a good one. It's tough reading, but it's a good one from a book on power, gender, and values. Finally, since the emphasis at Holden, one of the emphases at Holden this summer is environmental issues, and the theme is on earth as in heaven. One of the really helpful sets of discussions of environmental issues now is happening in feminist circles. And I may talk a little bit about this tomorrow, but I'll mention the book Healing the Wounds, The Promise of Ecofeminism. And of course it's edited by Judith Plant. I mean, how else, who else could do this? Healing the Promise of Ecofeminism, Judith Plant. All right. The article on Value, Power, and Gender, Do We Need a Different Voice, is one in which the writer, Linda Singer, comes to the conclusion that feminists do need to talk about the relationship of power seen as mutuality, reciprocity, nurture, partnership, etc., and power as coercion, and she argues for a feminist place for coercion. There's a response by Roger Scheiner, kind of trying to be clever. The response is entitled Attila the Hen. Only his response is deep regret. He's sorry that it's come to this, that she finally does say that there needs to be a place for exercise of coercion. He had hoped for better and more. He really had thought that mutual shared expressed power was possible for a society, and she concluded otherwise. So he's disappointed. All right. Now, what do feminists say about power? I want just to take a few minutes here and then get back to specifically the Jesus stuff and our discussion further. But I found that they're just so very helpful, and so I'm going to summarize some of this. In the literature that I've seen on feminism, the feminists all know that nothing ever happens apart from power. Nothing evil happens apart from power, and nothing good ever happens apart from power. There's a simple reason for this. Nothing happens without power, apart from power. And so feminists do stress the etiological and generic meaning of power as the capacity or the ability to endure or change or conserve a given state of affairs. Now, this inclusive meaning of power means that feminists invariably understand that power is never limited to domination and control or hard coercion. Power is never limited simply to the ability to compel obedience. That's not the only kind of power, and they know it. Nor is power, in their rendering, about successfully overcoming some resistance or other. Power is sometimes that, but they know that there are many kinds of power which aren't about overcoming resistance, getting your way in the face of opposition to it, which is a classical definition of power in the political science textbooks. And feminists know otherwise, and they usually say that men invariably assume that power is overcoming resistance. They also say that men usually think of power in what is technically called zero-sum, as a zero-sum game or a zero-sum reality. That is, men generally think that more power for one party means less power for the other party. That's what zero-sum means. More for one means less for the other. And feminists say that's true for some power, lots of power it's not true. For lots of power, feminists say, such as the power of nurture, more for one is all. The power of friendship is not a zero-sum kind of power. The power of friendship is one which both are empowered, back to Cora's word. Okay, but it's a common assumption that more power for one party is less for another. And feminists then are very critical of an understanding of power if it's only an exercise of domination in a competitive zero-sum struggle. And that's the way power is conceived. They say that misleads and that suppresses much of our actual experience of power in our lives. And it certainly doesn't account for nurture as a power. Okay. Feminists also, and I find this helpful beyond our topic, for all of our topics this week, also, knowing that nothing, say that since nothing happens apart from power, they stress its social pervasiveness. They agree with Amos Hawley, who says, every social act is an exercise of power, every social relationship is an equation of power, and every social group is an organization of power. That Nancy Hartsock says, the theories of power are implicitly theories of community. So that to analyze the power dimensions of social relations is to see how communities have been constructed and how they operate. Every relationship has some power dimension to it. Now the kinds of power vary, but it's power. And one needs to know that. All right. So expanding this slightly to cover all relationships, feminists contend that the modes of power and the understandings of power reflect the particular shape that relationships have taken. Human-to-human relationships, the relationship to God, is also a power relationship. Now, it may be, as in the hymn, a nurturing relationship. It may not be either. Maybe another kind of power relationship. But it's always some kind of power relationship. So power is a dimension of all relationships, and how relationships are structured determines the experience of power, indeed often the kind of power that is experienced. If relationships are structured in a certain way, then the power dimensions will reflect that. All right, then quickly, feminists have, in their writings about power, have emphasized the role that language plays. Language carries our sense of how the world is formed. language bears the world to us. Talked about socialization yesterday. Language is a major medium for socialization, for bearing the world to us. So, as I said yesterday, what we define as real in its consequences, and language helps us define what is real. So the feminists pay very close attention to how we image and speak of power, because how we image and speak of power either mirrors our world or puts forth an alternative to it. Okay, I'm going to just skip some more of this and summarize by saying that feminists recognize that there is such a thing as power over. They know about that. Many minorities know about power as power over. They know about power as benevolence, that is to say, power on behalf of someone is acting on behalf of someone else, has been instructed to or has taken it upon oneself. They reject both of those in favor of power as power with. Power with means, and I think it's put it this way, in most feminist paradigms, the only legitimate forms of power are forms of share. Power. May need coercion, but that's a resort. The preference is shared power. There's one nice little example. There's a church in Brooklyn. The congregation is mostly women. It's mostly ex-offenders or families of ex-offenders. Women who were at their wits' end in jail themselves, or where the husband or brother or children were in jail. It's an extraordinary congregation because the women have in that congregation themselves been empowered and I would say raised from the dying, if not the dead. But the name they chose for their church is Dunamis. Dunamis is a New Testament word for the power that you see in Jesus. And they, in their little newsletter from the Dunamis congregation, define Dunamis as reciprocal, shared, celebrated, passed on power. And that's a kind of nice emphasis for what feminists see as the power that ought to be further developed. Reciprocal, shared, celebrated, passed on kind of power. Okay, that's a quickie, but I wanted to say that there is considerable attention to power, and it's very helpful treatment of power, in my judgment, in a lot of the literature on being done by feminists. Now, we've got 20 minutes. Let's get back to discussion here. Do you see power as nurture in the life ministry and movement of and around Jesus?
Oh, we were just talking about in the Bible study this morning that Jesus caring for, raising Lazarus, comforting Mary and Martha and their bereavement, a whole series of healing and caring for signs, yeah, in the Gospel of John, and some of the other ones we touched on earlier in the week of using, I guess he would be coercing diseases out of the people, but it's certainly caring for their needs and meeting them.
Mm-hmm. Healing becomes a prime sort of metaphor as well as descriptor of that kind of ministry and of nurture in many circumstances. And while it may be true that you could say coercing the disease out, I mean, the larger reality is that one's own body must do a great deal of that healing, but it's very dependent often upon the care of others in order for that to happen. Yeah. Yeah. More about Jesus here. Linda, you mustn't overlook the balcony people here.
On the other hand, one of the things that came up in the discussion of John this morning is that in some ways these stories are illustrative and there's not a kind of ongoingness that I associate in some sense with nurture and with some of the images that you're talking about in community, where the Jesus community, it seems to me, almost comes later. Some of these things have a somewhat different quality. They're, the exception being, say, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, where there's this suggestion of
a long friendship or something.
A long friendship of some kind. But
many of them are episodic.
There's a kind of an insight and a real moment of something happening, but then they go on in the story to another story, which is quite different from our own lives.
It's a little more episodic, whereas nurture as a power requires some continuity of a relationship very often. It can happen episodically, and does, but it is a kind of long-haul power. Yeah.
Well, the long-term nurturing is Jesus' nurturing of his disciples.
Mm-hmm.
And that is nurturing
all the way through. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
In Jesus' life, and even what you read, there's kind of a confusion in my mind about the relationship between love and power. I was thinking about it, even again what you were reading from Feminist View, seem to be awfully closely related.
Yes.
Do they talk about that? When I think about the kind of power that I see in Christ, in his ability to, the act of healing, I see that as an act of power, but also an act of love, both at the same time. And a lot of what he did, as I know from my own experience, as power, but also as an act of love. And so, I guess I'm confused. What is the difference in that particular context?
What is the difference between love and power?
Right.
Let me just preface this. I wish now I had brought along a preface from a book by Ronald Sampson that some years ago was really quite popular in pastoral care. And it was quite typical of Sampson to make a sharp distinction between love and power. And it's been characteristic in the history of Christian ethics to make a considerable distinction between the two, to put love on one end of a spectrum and power on the other end of a spectrum, and to contrast the two. And then to associate Jesus with love and power with coercion. And then to portray Jesus, in fact, as relatively powerless, almost making a virtue of his powerlessness as expressive of love. And the feminists have been very critical of that, because it does not see love as a power. It understands, again, power chiefly in terms of force and a competitive zero-sum kind of understanding of power. And it fails to see that Jesus was not powerless, but Jesus kind of servanthood and healing and nurturing power is an alternative form of power itself. rather than powerlessness. That is a power, and it works in a particular kind of way. So some of the feminists and others would say to you, there are many kinds of powers, and love is one of those kinds of powers. Other things you see in Jesus around this topic of power is nurture. Yeah.
One strong image for me, even though Jesus does it sadly, is when he says, "How I wanted to gather you under my wings,"
yeah.
That as a hen,
yeah,
her brood,
yeah.
And I have this wonderful big brown chicken.
Yeah. Yeah, this hymn is very much like that. I mean, you could almost have taken the "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how I would have gathered you." Although he says it, you're right, he says it sadly there, and this is a kind of, this isn't said sadly, but it's the same image of the mother hen there. We were hiking back from Mirror Lake last Sunday and came across a grouse with her baby chicks right on the trail. And when we approached, all of the little chicks ran under the mother grouse. The little chicks were about this long, you know, and they were all under there. And if you got down and you looked at ground level, you could see about 8 pairs of feet under this one hen. You couldn't see the rest of the chicks, just the feet. And then she just sort of wiggled along and the whole troop moved there all together. She was protecting them, gathering them, you know, and then she just stayed there, and then we went by, and then the chicks went off and did what they were doing before, you know, and she was watching. It was a lovely picture. Yeah.
Something else too that I think of when I think of like Jesus and nurture is that, because a lot of the interactions were episodic, but that the gift of his presence,
yeah,
there's that sense of clarity where he can just zing right in and see that person, not judge them by their actions, but see the goodness of that person and the potential. So I think of people in my life who've been nurturing and people who have that kind of presence, that they're there and not caught up in their own stuff, but that they're seeing me.
Yeah. And sometimes it's seeing them and seeing in them a power they did not know they had, but which is drawn out in the process. If we had more days, what I would like to do is to take the Sermon on the Mount and the go 2 miles and turn the other cheek and those famous instructions as instructions given to utterly powerless people who had no other kind of power by which to face Rome or the tax collectors. But when Jesus said, "You can go the second mile," it completely disarms the Roman soldier. When someone whom he can conscript to do that for 1 mile volunteers to do it the second, or turns the other cheek. In this particular case, you slap a person on one cheek, and if they turn the other cheek, then you've got to use the back of your hand, which in that kind of society is done between people who are equals, who are at enmity with one another. So both relationships have been changed by those actions of powerless people. They then are taking the initiative when they have felt utterly without any power at all. It's a little bit like the garbage workers in Memphis taking up a sign and saying, "I am a man," in the civil rights movement. Now pretty soon they're getting uppity because they feel some power that they in fact have. But nobody came along with that kind of spotting of them and saying, "You, yes, who you want to be, who you in a deep sense are, become."
Picking up on that, power as linkage motif. Going into the book of Acts, I think of the appointing of the 70 to mm-hmm. do the work of the mm-hmm. early church, and mm-hmm. linking up that way and distributing the power and working together in a sort of a collegial relationship and encouraging one another that way.
There's a nice, you know, in Greek, the word koinonia, which we translate as fellowship or community, is the word Paul also uses for the offering that's taken in Corinth for the poor Christians in Jerusalem. The richer Christians are in Corinth. Now, how are they going to break bread together with the Christians in Jerusalem when they're not going to see them, but they're a part of the same fellowship? The koinonia is expressed by some giving at this time to those who don't have. And Paul says that there may be equality. You have more at the moment, they have less. There will come another time when they may have less and you'll have more. But he's trying to link on the basis of a kind of mutuality and equality. And even in that case, even the economics of it reflects it. Koinonia is the name of the offering, as well as the fellowship. Yeah.
Jesus was also accessible, and he included many, many groups of people.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he didn't send away the children. He wanted them to come to him. He was open to having them come to him. Yeah. And he was willing to sit down with tax collectors and all kinds of sinners.
Yeah.
You know, including people instead of excluding people.
Yeah.
And that's a very powerful thing to do.
That may be the basic, whether nurturing happens or not, inclusion or exclusion. Yeah. Let's see if there are any more. Yeah, Dan.
I'm reminded
people
of
who haven't spoken yet.
John 15:15, where Jesus at the last Passover feast says to the disciples, "I do not call you servants, for the servants don't know what the master is doing. I call you friends, for everything I have received, I have given to you. To love one another as I have loved you."
Yeah.
That's a pretty radical statement of community that's not very hierarchical.
Yeah, no, friends. I no longer call you servants, but friends.
Yeah.
Yes, Chuck.
Tying the scientific or the mathematic with the theology of this thing, it seems to me there's no doubt about where our energy should be placed. On one side you have the zero-sum power thing where power can basically not be created or destroyed, but over on the other side, the nurturing or love side, where power can be created,
mm-hmm.
it seems our battleground should be over on the nurturing and the love side, and our efforts should be over there a little more than sometimes where we place them.
You might choose a different metaphor than battleground, but I understand what you're saying. Well, one of the serious questions now put to this discussion of the various forms of power, including power as nurture, is how might such power, as you're pointing to, be developed for society? I mean, we live in an epoch which, because the Earth is getting smaller and the human capacity to impact the Earth, both negatively and positively, but that includes negatively, is growing, and we have such capacities for destruction. It's a very serious practical question of how do you find the forms, especially the community forms, the societal forms, the systemic forms for economy, politics, etc., of power it will include some coercion, but it needs to be others. The promised next volume after this is a volume on proposed kind of models. How do we get from the sketch of a partnership model to the reality of that in society? That's a serious practical question. It's not just a question for utopian dreaming. It's a serious practical question in our kind of world. And there are lots of struggles for that. I haven't had a chance to read Václav Havel's book, The President of Czechoslovakia, But he has a book now, or a long essay published as a booklet, called The Power of the Powerless, in which he talks about the struggle there and the efforts in Czechoslovakia to find a way to avoid power exercise primarily as domination, and instead as a power of people with one another. Okay, our time is about up. I just want to quickly mention one more thing about Jesus, and also then mention something about how this kind of power not only can go wrong, does go wrong, and what kind of power can heal it. I ask you, what do you see in Jesus? And we talked about the people around Jesus. That's perfectly appropriate. But we should not close the session without noting Jesus' relationship to God in these terms. Because that Aramaic word, Abba, Father, is a word in Aramaic which is distinguished from other words that might have been used for Father. And its distinction is the kind of Father who is intimate, who is close, in whom I, who embraces me. It's the kind of Father that is a nurturer. It's the kind of Father who has motherly qualities, if you will. And the gospel writers are very careful. They don't have Jesus using Jesus' own tongue very often. Only once in a while do you have an Aramaic word in the Koine Greek. That's a glimpse into the soul where that happens. It happens a couple of times. Abba, and on the cross, the only sentence in Aramaic, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. There, Eloi is the word for one who is distant, who is not close, who has abandoned. It's as if you said to your friend, why has God forsaken me? Only now you're saying to God, but God is not present. Now we would need to go through, to get to feel the power of this, we need to go through that Markan account where one after another abandons Jesus. Every situation is one in which Jesus is abandoned, whether it's in Gethsemane, or whether it's in the trial by Peter, or wherever it is, at every single point, Jesus is abandoned. You and I think of the thieves on the cross as one where Jesus, you know, says, today you will be with me in paradise. Not in Mark's account. They turn on him and rebuke him in Mark's account. And then God abandons Jesus. And it's not Abba at all. It's Eloi. I say that for a couple of reasons. One is the one that Jesus experiences the loss of the nurturing center himself in his own life, which is who is God. Some of us understand that. And one theory about the writer of Mark is that Mark is writing to a congregation in Rome that has, in fact, under persecution, abandoned Jesus. And Mark wants to kind of, in a pastoral nurturing care, say, Jesus has been there before you, if you have experienced abandonment. Now, it's a very different sense, but here's an utterly broken relationship at that moment to the power that has sustained Jesus through through all of this, and it's reflected in that Aramaic contrast with Eloi. Finally, and to close, that of course is not the end of the story, and it is God who vindicates the way of Jesus, and it is the way of Jesus that triumphs. All I want to say, and I don't want to let the example deter from the point, is that the only kind of power that heals, the power of broken relationships where nurture is the power, is nurture itself. Coercion can't heal the power that has focused, that has come about by nurture. Coercion doesn't restore any friendships, just to pick one example. Or ideology. You can't give good reasons and make sense of the world. And that itself doesn't restore the kind of power when the power of nurture goes wrong, as it does. It will be Jesus staying with God despite the abandonment, in the sense of abandonment, and God staying with Jesus, even though Jesus' sense is that he is abandoned. That is the only kind of power that can overcome the brokenness that does happen in relationships in which nurture is the power. So this is a power that, like all powers, can go wrong. It's also a kind of power that is required for the righting of certain kind of relationships where nurture is the power. Now that may all sound like a tautology, but I think that it resonates with our experience. And I think sometimes we often try to use other kinds of powers to heal what only further nurturing and repair of those kinds can do. We try to use sanctions of other sorts to get things right again when it's only this kind of power that can. Okay, thank you.